Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. I first read the science fiction or speculative fiction writer Jack Womack back in the cyberpunk 1980s, his early works, especially Ambient and Terraplane, come vividly to mind. At the time, Jack was one of the writers picking up on the sort of more hard-edged, political, gritty, satirical side of that particular science fiction moment, and he has continued writing books in his Draco series of speculative fictions, but that's not what we're here to talk about today, because it turns out that Mr. Womack, who is from Kentucky but lives in New York City and has lived there for many a moon, is also, and has been for quite a long time, a collector of arcane UFO-related literature. And has just put out an absolutely delightful and delicious book, which is really a must get for folks like me, at least, and I'm sure many others out there, called Flying Saucers Are Real, The UFO Library of Jack Womack. And it really is a library, as in a serious collection, and in fact has recently become part of the, I think it's pronounced the Luinger Library at Georgetown University, has made a permanent home for the Jack Womack UFO Library. So it's no joke. It's not the standard volumes you've seen in used bookstores or new bookstores. It's a really remarkable collection, and this book collects the images of the books, selections, diagrams, illustrations, photographs, from a wide range of fanzines, journals, and of course, lots and lots of books. And it's because Jack's a great writer, it has these really tart, witty, wry comments, putting the literature in context. And, you know, it's really one of the great ways to approach, you know, a question like this, like what is the UFO? Are UFOs real? What is all this ufology about? People have all these arguments, all of these documents they'll point to, but in a way, the most concrete thing we have is UFO literature. So it's a really an amazing place to start. The most concrete thing we can say about the whole scene is that it produced a lot of wacky books and with wonderful covers. And now you can not collect the books themselves, but just get the covers and some very, very ace commentary and context from Jack with this new book. So with no further ado, let's bring Jack onto the show. Jack, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Hello, Eric. First of all, let me check to see. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, sounds pretty good.
Okay, well, I can hear you, so I think we're set. So.
Excellent.
Thank you for the nice introduction.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I know you start out the book, you talk about the first book in your collection, but I think it is a cool place to start. It sort of tells us something about you, where you're coming from, and really just why, how you got into, you know, this whole zone.
I first heard about it when I picked up the book Strange World by Frank Edwards, about which I'd heard on television back in 1964. That was the first book I purchased, and that was like your usual collection of strange events from the 60s. I was small at the time. I was 8 years old. But that was interesting enough that it led me to pick up more books as they came out. I didn't really believe what was in there, but it was intriguing enough that, like other friends of mine with science fiction, it was sort of like working on their sense of wonder and possibility initially. Then, of course, the more I read in the field, the more I realized that there's a certain lack of possible actualities behind it. But the more I then I became more interested in just the whole vibe of the whole thing, the whole caress. It's just like the way that this field, even early on, was shaping up as something entirely separate from everything else, yet working on what was here, the way so many things, political, social, etc., happened in the same way since then. And I just got, like I say, rather than science fiction, I got into these flying saucer books initially, which of course are just about as fictional as science fiction. But at the same time, I just approached it from a different angle, which is why I think the science fiction I've written is always slightly different from the average. So, but only that's very, very idiosyncratic.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the things you do I really like is, you know, a conventional story about modern flying saucers almost always begins with Kenneth Arnold's sighting in the summer of 1947. You do something different, which is that you begin your story with the Shaver mystery and Ray Palmer. And we've talked about the Shaver and Ray Palmer on the show before, but we'd love to get a little your take on that. But you choose to start there and then go on to Arnold, which I think is actually a really subtle and incisive reframing of the narrative, because it really puts the story of the flying saucer into a larger framework of the kind of pulp slippage between fantasy and purported fiction that emerges in pulp literature, that Ray Palmer was kind of a genius of fudging and stirring up fascination for these outre topics in a way that clearly draws from fiction rather than starting with Kenneth Arnold as this sort of experiential report that appears in the newspaper that has a little bit more of a sense of being a kind of historical fact, whatever the reality of the saucers were. But you choose to start off with the kind of Shaver mystery and Palmer. So tell me why you did that.
Well, the Shaver mystery is sort of the practice run for flying saucers in a way that certainly wasn't clear at the time, but which helped Palmer naturally know how to go when the first saucers appeared. The Shaver mystery originated, just to give a brief background of what that picture was, when Palmer, who was the editor of Amazing Stories at the time, and published a lot of pulp science fiction, and also published Isaac Asimov's first short story, and published Virgil Finlay, the artist, his work for the first time. And then one day, there arrived in the office a letter from Richard S. Shaver, who explained that he had discovered the original language of mankind, which he called Mantong, and that he would be happy to tell Palmer more. And so Palmer's assistant threw it in the trash, but Palmer recovered it and said, "Could I see some more?" And so Shaver wrote him back with about 10,000 words of explaining, called A Warning to Future Man, and explaining how before mankind there had lived on the earth the old ones, the great ones, who are descendants of Lemuria, and that they had to leave the earth because of incredibly ridiculous complications involving the carbon chill, the sun burning away, if I recall right. And the ones who stayed here became known as Giro, or degenerative robots. This is the abbreviation Giro. And this was published as nonfiction and Amazing Stories by Palmer, and it drew a huge response. And for a couple of years, circulation mounted. People would write in to like their experiences with the basically non-existent Giro, but nonetheless their experiences that they came up with on their own. And this worked well for a couple of years. And around the time it was starting to die off or lose out in popularity, Arnold saw his flying saucers. And Palmer naturally, while continuing with the Shaver mystery, naturally switched over to the saucer problem, which ultimately became the more successful of the two. I described it as like the Elvis to the Shaver mystery's Jesse Garon in the book, which seemed like a fairly close comparison.
Combination, and I like the kind of rock and roll echo. And later in the book, of course, there's a wonderful cover for a book that connects Elvis to the flying saucer. So I realize there's there's more, there's always leakage in this thing. But it seems to me like one of the important things about the, or most important things in some ways about the Shaver mystery in its relationship to the UFO and to other sorts of high weirdness in modern subculture or modern culture is again the way that people wrote into Amazing Stories, not just saying, wow, that was really trippy or that was like a dream I had, but telling their own stories about experiences with these same creatures. And while we can, you know, you can chalk up some of that to people who were just having a lark or to people who had their own fictional stories to tell and decided to tell it as if it was part of the same universe of the Darrow, there's something else going on. There's some way about how pulp, you know, the pulp zone of fiction and paranormal fictions and facts and claims kind of create a space for a weirdly archetypal sort of thing to emerge where people start to create these collective myths that actually some people kind of experience. So people experience that way. So it's a strange zone, and then it just takes off with the UFO, in a huge kind of way. What's your sense of that, of like how fiction masquerading as fact or vice versa creates a space, at least in the 20th century or certain zones of 20th century culture, for this kind of mass, whether you want to call it hallucination or a mass mythology, to emerge and really shape the way people see things, at least in their imaginations?
Well, I think a lot of, Jung was the first psychologist to study the phenomenon and say, as near as he could tell, that is essentially arising from atomic bomb fears initially. As it went on, as the fad for flying saucers continued, it gradually began to expand into more and more fields, initially with other paranormal fields, with Bigfoot, for example, or with strange lights in the sky that seemed not to be flying saucers and such, and then gradually expanded into the paranoiac area, which is so well done in the U.S., and that this is just like, you know, it became more and more part of things to be afraid of, not so much welcome. And that started in the 50s when it was still like, if they weren't communists, then they must be Golden Space Brothers. If it became clear that they weren't either, that's around the time that you start seeing the, you know, appearance of little gray aliens in stories that would capture people and not be very nice to them. And it's interesting just how in the way it had changed from something supposedly innocent at its base in the 50s to something that was far more malevolent by the 80s.
Yeah, it's clearly a kind of map or mirror of a whole set of cultural, you know, obsessions and concerns. And that's one of the things that's so cool about tracking it, and also the way in which you present in one volume, you get to get a real taste of all of these different characters, the authors, the way that the books appeared, the way they would have affected initial buyers, and then these juicy citations. So we get a sense of all of these different characters coming from so many different perspectives. And it's these range of perspectives that's part of what makes it so vivid and representative of deeper issues in the culture. And one of those, for example, is this this tension that you call rationalists and irrationalists, where on the one hand, you know, there's these claims, and some of the people who were seeing things floating in the sky were reputable people or military pilots, and there was a kind of consistency in their claims, and maybe there were, you know, bizarre things that were being made by the military or whatever that they were actually seeing. But regardless of that, some people just looked at this and said, okay, well, if this is real, then we can apply reason and science and try to track it and then develop. So there's a kind of rationalist discourse that tends to be skeptical, but not entirely dismissive. applying the tools of reason and kind of looking for nuts and bolts crafts, actual crafts, how could they work, where would they come from, et cetera, et cetera. And at the same time, there's this explosion of religious fantasy, of theosophical ideas and other occult ideas remixed with revelations and, you know, total, and some of it just like Pulp Fiction being blasted out. So already there's this weird kind of tension between, as you put it, the rationalists and the irrationalists. What is it about this particular zone that lets us see kind of both sides of this, the human approach to mystery, if you will, the rationalist approach and the irrationalist approach? And we need not say which one sold more copies.
Well, because I think the main thing is that the problem is always attempting to apply rational technique to investigating the phenomena when so you're working from the wrong premise to start with. Often they're starting from, obviously these are from somewhere far away, and you rule out, it's not communists, it's not us, it can only be from some other planet. And that's, of course, skipping a few, you know, areas to get to the realization. So, but it provides lots of entertainment in the meantime, whether natural or just unrealized at the time. But the intellectual fascination as well, I think, with some of the authors played as much a role as with actual belief. I think Gerald Hurd, I think the friend of Huxley, and Christopher Isherwood early on, who wrote Is Another World Watching and posited that Martians were actually intelligent insects, was working from that principle but somehow went completely wrong. There's another author in the book who came up with a completely well-realized study of why the flying saucers were from Mars, but for this theory to work, he had to, you know, rely upon the existence of Martian canals, which again sort of left the thesis in the dust when it came down to finally going anywhere. But they're all, you know, rationally applied ideas, but just to irrational concepts, or concepts that weren't fully thought out, or ones that just worked from the wrong proposition in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it's some of the books in your book or in your collection, come from skeptics as well, people who are just really like looking at what we can really say about it, what we actually know about these things, all of the inconsistencies and problems in the accounts. Do you tend, as a kind of collector or a someone who has a map of the whole zone, do you tend to see these skeptical voices as sort of, you know, valiantly, if somewhat Sisyphus-like characters attempting to, cleanse this whole squirrely world of all of its goofiness? Or in some sense, do you see the skeptics as kind of part of the dynamic, I mean, part of the overall world, that in some ways they're just as much beholden to the UFO myth or meme as the people who are just putting out, you know, extreme fantasies?
Well, it's an interesting point, because the skeptics are certainly hold part of the entire flying saucer gestalt, as it were, from when it originated. But fighting valiantly against the ongoing rush of ignorance is the best way to put it. I think we've seen similar situations in the recent past of reality being questioned, and it shouldn't be. And this was, like, I think the skeptics, though, as you point say, after a while they developed into the, no, I just, like, they don't exist, I'll prove it. To some degree, I think Martin Gardner fell into that, though not fully. Carl Sagan, to a small degree, and many of the authors who actually specifically wrote the books, James Oberg is a good example, very smart fellow, wrote great books on the Soviet space program, basically when nothing was known about them except what he was able to dig up. And he wrote his books, you know, that say that, well, we're really looking, but we don't find any evidence they exist, are beautifully thought out. But, of course, it was the skeptical books that never sold. And so it was basically, for a while there, it was like, not completely over the top, but just accepting enough to admit that they might be real. Those were always the ones that were most successful, because when you got to the contactees and the more loopier phrases, you know, just spaceship moon and that sort of thing, then you would tend to drop off to a much smaller demographic. But as long as it was generally like a search for scientific evidence of flying saucers while we're planning to go to the moon and this sort of thing, this tied in very nicely with the space age of the time in America, certainly, because it was another astronomical thing that allowed for more imagination than trying to get, you know, escape velocity and that area of science, as opposed to the more imaginative area.
Yeah, I get the impression from some of the way you write about the history in your book that you sense that something really kind of changes in the late 60s with Apollo 11. There's kind of, even though there's a lot of interest in the UFOs in the 60s, something kind of shifts as we go into the 70s, which has its own kind of UFO culture, something about the naivete, something about the nature of space, the fact that we actually did make it to the moon, at least according to the mainstream narrative. There are many doubters these days about whether we actually got to the moon. But overall, there are these sort of waves of interest in the UFO, but they seem to change over time based on other things that are going on in the culture and in science.
That's true. And the initial wave after Arnold's sighting was mainly just, there are thousands of these things floating around, what are they? By the time the second wave rolled around 1952, this was a time when one evening, for example, radar was picking up hundreds of identified objects over Washington, D.C., which was never identified quite what they were, but basically radar ghosts and that sort of thing, as near as anyone can tell now. But that was more in response to invasion. The reaction was either Soviet invasion or enemies from within. That was right during, of course, the height of the McCarthy period. And then after that faded, then it's turned into just more low-key until the end of the 50s, at which time Sputnik and the getting underway of the American space program put fanciful things in the background for a while until the mid-60s, at which point John Fuller, a journalist for Life and Look, among others, wrote two books, and one was An Incident of Exeter, and that was about a number of sightings at the Wanacue Reservoir in upper New Jersey in 65, and then followed that up with The Interrupted Journey, which was the story of Barney and Betty Hill, who in the early 60s were interrupted by a flying saucer. And this was, theirs was the first experience of being taken aboard, remembering only later through the process of hypnosis and recovered memories, etc., and then introduced to little gray men. And then, fascinating as the story was, and it was a bestseller, both of these books were national bestsellers for weeks, the little gray man ideal didn't really sink in the public consciousness, as I say, till Whitley Strieber picked it back up again in the late 70s, and then it just really took off with his Communion, and then every single alien sighting after that seemed to be a little gray man.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting one. You know, I'm kind of curious, this is slightly, a slightly different angle. It's something you don't really address in your book, but I'm curious. I know that in your fiction, you play with issues of race in America. You imagine a different kind of parallel evolution of America where the Civil War didn't happen, and so there's, you know, even nastier racial relations in later American history. In terms of African Americans and who are going undercover and all this sort of complexity of that. And it always struck me really interesting that Barney Hill of this sort of primary contact
interracial
alien couple was a light-skinned black man. They were, you know, committing at that point a sort of brazen act of miscegenation in terms of the way that normal American culture, because Betty Hill was white. And that always just struck me as sort of odd. Nothing, I never really saw anybody kind of develop it or think about what that would mean. Maybe it's just an odd, you know, fact of history with no meaning. But I'm curious, what do you think about that?
I always thought that was purely coincidence. Though, as you say, a fascinating way, I've looked at that and tried to see if there is much, because, you know, both, you know, people of all races have seen flying saucers or thought they have seen flying saucers. But that did stand out, though I think it was pure. The more I've thought about it, it's the more you look at the Kennedy assassination, eventually you just get down to, well, I think it just happened that way. And I think with Barney and Betty Hill, I think they just happened to be the ones who were driving along, and whatever happened to them. And I have, like, let's see, I have Betty Hill's second book where she told her personal story about it, which was very much like Fuller's, in the collection. And nothing ever stands out. Just like, yes, we were married, so what? So, you know. And you just, I'm not, it's a fascinating possibility, but I just, like, but I've never seen anything more than just than the likelihood that it was purely accidental that they were the ones who were covering. I don't remember a huge thing being made of it at the time in the mid-60s, though it was noted. It was inevitably noted in Life, you know, Look. I forget which magazine ran it. I think it was Look. But it was never anything to make a big thing ever. It was just sort of like, oh, which actually is surprising looking back on it. But I've not seen anything since then that leads me to think that anything specifically racial developed from it, at least in the general American mind, and that most of the cases that were ever covered publicly, except for Barney and Betty Hill, tended to be of white guys.
Yeah. Fascinating. And in your comment just a moment ago, you mentioned the JFK assassination. And of course, as you also point out in the book, the aspect of the whole UFOs world that is most alive today is the more paranoid conspiracy theory, you know, whether or not it's the rulers of the world are actually aliens, or whether it's that the military is, you know, using UFOs to mind control, or, you know, that side of the story tends to be the one that people are that's more alive online and in the kind of public imagination. Where does that originate? Where do we start to see that side of the picture? Is it there from the beginning, and when does it really start to kind of, you know, as it were, flower into its own inside the UFO literature?
Well, flowers like kudzu, it sort of grows over everything. Kehoe was actually the first writer, and he was one of the serious writers. You know, he was old Lindy's pilot in the cross-country tour in the late 20s, and he was with the military, and he actually came to believe that the military, that the U.S. military was hiding the truth about flying saucers purely for national security reasons, though he could not figure out what those reasons were. And Kehoe, of course, always fell back on the, well, let's have a congressional investigation of flying saucers. You know, never really asking exactly what good this is going to do. But he was very much the one who first put into public thought the notion that someone was hiding something from us, which was later picked up by Gray Barker and other saucer favorites. Now, concurrently, the entire modern conspiracy theory platform, as it were, was getting underway following the assassination of Kennedy. There were some strange overlaps, or unexpected overlaps here and there. I mean, as I know in the book, Fred Crisman, who was involved with the first major flying saucer theoretical contactee or abductee or saucer danger case, the Maury Island incident. Fred Crisman, who was a major participant in that, turned up later, 20 years ago, as being one of the first people Jim Garrison called when he reopened the Kennedy assassination case and indicted Clay Shaw. And Clay Shaw was the first person Crisman had called after you know, the assassination, which is a sort of odd coincidence, but nothing has ever been connected from it. And since then, flying saucers, at least on the very edges, became involved with assassination plots, and assassination plots became involved with saucers, and Men in Black showed up, started showing up in both of them. And then it became more and more elaborate as time went on, and they started retrofitting things like the M-12 documents and Eisenhower's brought to Wright Patterson Field to take a look at the Nazi flying saucers recaptured. A number of urban stories and legends developed from that. And as the 60s continued, on a low level, they were, you know, churning together, that it didn't really come into full blossom or full growth, as it were, until the 80s, I don't think. And then the paranoiac side has continued to grow within the field, even as it has shrunk further and further away from a general popular belief or interest.
Yeah, it seems to feed just the growing concerns people have about everything these days. So it kind of makes sense.
Right.
Became progressively darker. A friend of mine pointed out something, since you have a lot of material from the early years and are a student of the zone, I'm actually just kind of curious how you respond to this, that if you go back and you look at the newspapers, at the early material from the late 40s to the early 50s, that there's actually relatively little sort of discussion or assumption that these have anything to do with outer space, that a lot of the UFOs were just weird objects in the sky. They could be crafts. Maybe they were Russian. Maybe who knows what they were. But it wasn't that in 1949, in 1950, 1951, if you were a citizen who was interested in UFOs, you weren't necessarily thinking very much about aliens or extraterrestrials. You were just thinking about these weird things in the sky, and that it was only kind of later that it becomes so identified with this idea of aliens. Is that true?
That's pretty true, yeah, because the very first case, no one knew what they were. It was the same as with, before even Arnold's sighting, there's been sightings of what they called the ghost rockets in Sweden in 1946. But those were believed at the time, and I believe have since proved to have been so. Russian tests of various sorts of things that they would see. And so the first couple of years, the belief was, oh, no, these probably aren't. No, the planetary thesis had not formed yet. I don't think that started coming around until the early 50s, and notably with 1950s Behind the Flying Saucers with Frank Scully, who basically presented as true a story he had been told by a couple of con men out in the Nevada desert, who claimed that the government had found this flying saucer with these little men who had burned alive. When they came in, they had the saucer hidden in the back. And that was the first time, I think, the planetary thesis had been presented to a general public. And that, of course, was the big bestseller Behind the Flying Saucers. It was the big bestsellers of 1950 were that book and Kehoe's The Flying Saucers Are Real, one of which was very sober and straightforward, and the other of which was, yeah, a little man in the desert, yeah, out there, no, it happened, the government's not telling you. So you had the two sides of the phenomena from the very start, pretty much. And, of course, as the way it turned out, as more and more scientific evidence proved to show nothing, the more imaginative side of the debate was carrying the day and continues to carry the day today, I think.
Yeah. What do you think about the idea that there's a sort of more down-to-earth government conspiracy, which is not that they are hiding the truth of aliens in our midst, but rather that at least certain elements of military intelligence has used and even promulgated some of this mythology as a way to both kind of play with mass belief, but also to cloak very real developments in weaponry and strange aircraft. and that there's sort of an active role. You know, we had, for example, Mark Pilkington on the show talking about his book Mirage Men, which basically, you know, talks about individuals inside military intelligence who he was in, you know, that they were wasn't like conspiracy stuff. It was just like guys who came out and said, yeah, this is what we were doing, and in ways in which certain elements of the lore were kind of actively played with as a way to create a kind of smoke screen. Does that make sense to you, or does that seem like another version of the need to find the plot behind everything?
No, actually, I think there's considerable validity to that, because for one thing, we know that this was done in England from records that have been released about their sightings over there, that often they were used exactly for this. They said, oh, we can use this for propaganda purposes, we can use this to hide what we're doing over here. And I think probably a number, you know, there have been very few sightings that haven't been identified in some way or the other, but I think a number of the still unidentified sightings out west in particular, like over the desert and such, have almost certainly been sightings of U.S. military aircraft, which could not be explained at the time, obviously, but which weren't really explained since until, like, you know, they start releasing records from 1947, which they just now are getting around to doing, so they're usually about 60 years behind the times in terms of speed. But, yeah, I think, and then using the concepts, the flying saucers, for their own propaganda, I'm sure that's also been done. But what's been done at what time is just kind of hard to pin down. But I think you can look over it and just see what has been released and the fact that, you know, the CIA and everyone was much far more interested in the phenomena than they were ever letting on at the time, which, you know, again, makes perfect sense that they would have been and that they wouldn't have said that they were, specifically for the reasons they always gave, which is we don't want to panic the population. Because clearly the government had no clear idea initially as to what these things were. If there were things, then the people did.
In some ways you look at the lore, look at all the material, and it you can't help but see it as almost like an experimenter in the creation of belief, and whether or not individuals were doing it just to, you know, because they were overwhelmed with their own fantasies, because they had genuine anomalous experiences that they had to talk about, and those were the terms they were going to talk about them, whether they were self-serving hucksters who wanted to cash in. But there's also a sense that it's almost like a kind of experiment. You know, like, let's see how far we can push it. Let's see how, and I don't know who the we is in that situation, but there is a way in which this particular zone of all of the, you know, cryptozoology and other Freudian topics and other paranoid conspiracies or whatever, there's something particular about the UFO zone that feels like everybody had their hand in. Everybody wanted to, Hollywood wanted to tweak it, the religious people wanted to tweak it, everybody wanted to tweak it in some way. So it's this amazing mirror of manipulation and the creation of belief.
Yes, I think flying saucer would like the best example of that within the field of paranoia normal, where you had something that anyone could look at the phenomena and read into it whatever they wanted. They could say, this is an example of why the Soviets have to be watched, or this is an example why, you know, Space Brothers will come down and help us all, or this is why Space Brothers will come down and kill us all. And you could pretty much come up with any thesis. It was very wide open back then because there was nothing, no actuality to prove from, but so it all boiled down to, can you prove it didn't happen? Of course, then when you're trying to prove a negative, you can pretty much come up with anything if you want to, and I think a lot of people took advantage of that. And then later, the mythology then got totally renewed with a different charge coming from a different angle, with the X-Files, which, you know, the first 4 years it was on was extremely good till they finally just, you know, they got way over their heads plotting. but they had a couple of their episodes actually were using genuine, you know, the people who wrote the episodes actually knew the sort of lunacies they were writing about and were able to take them and make them into popular entertainment, which then became, through the usual system of filtration, part of the accepted belief, and one on a broader sense that, oh yes, there are flying saucers out there, they're aliens, and they're probably run by the government, and the government will, you know, is trying to kill us even worse than the aliens. And it's just, again, just opening up a whole new field for paranoia there, which people took it and ran with it.
I have another kind of question. In my experience, following this stuff, and you already had alluded to sort of weird coincidences between the JFK and the UFO world, and that that when you enter into these zones of rumors and paranoia and fiction, the blurring of fiction and fact, and all of those kinds of information games, that sort of strange coincidences or just a sense of weirdness starts to permeate your research, even if you're approaching it in a very skeptical, grounded framework. And I'm wondering, as you devoted yourself to amassing a real collection, like something where you're really focused, where you're on the hunt, where you're looking for very obscure items, where and you devoted a long time to developing this really remarkable collection. I'm curious if along the way there were sort of weirdnesses just in the collecting of the material, of finding certain things, of stumbling across things, of just moments where it almost felt like the collection was sort of, developing itself through you, and you almost were, not in charge of the process, if you know what I mean.
That's a really interesting point. Yeah, because actually my collection as a whole, when I sold the UFO books to Georgetown, that's only part of the collection I have here, because I still have all my books by Cranks, positing that the 10 Lost Tribes of Israel were dinosaurs, or that all glass should be blue because blue light is healthier than clear glass. And then, of course, cryptozoology. I have a large amount for Tana. I have a large amount. And basically, it's just like I had my library has eventually turned into a collection of anything ultra, and just didn't really fit anywhere else. It was like Charles Fort said, I closed the doors to Jesus, I opened the doors to little frogs that come in the back way. That fall from the sky. But the collection itself it did take on its own life after a while and sort of took over most of the house. So it's cut back considerably now. They've kept all the best stuff except for the flying saucers. But I never had anything. I had certainly had memorable experiences when I would find something I'd been looking for a long time. I found those sexy saucer people only after about looking for it for 25 years, I think. And then finally a friend of mine, who is another paperback collector, had come upon a copy, so I traded the one that's presently at Georgetown for three books by Ed Wood, old paperbacks, which actually are now at Cornell, but because I sold off the Slee selection a few years ago as well. But it's just like it's the library just sort of came into being, and the people like Bill Gibson when he first came over just was like, you're just like, Jesus, how long have you been doing this? I said, it happened. They just find me. And that was usually the case. That was the only mysterious thing. Usually the strangest books would wind up jumping out at me at bookstores. I developed the knack after a while of like knowing which shelves to reach up to and finding something. I did that with the first issue of Fate that's in the collection. I found that at Village Books in Bellingham in October 1994 by just reaching up onto a shelf and finding and thinking, what's this? And I pulled it, oh, it's the first issue of Fate and it's a dollar. Great. So that sort of incident I have millions of. But in terms of anything odd, weird, or supernatural, no.
No, that was actually more what I was referring to, is that weird sense of, and I've been on a few research projects that took on that character of books kind of leaping off of shelves that I just had the impulse to look at. And I have a friend who has a remarkable collection, more along the lines of what you and your friends have been doing of weirdness and esoterica, really impressive collection, a lot of which he's amassed not by spending bucks on it, but just by being in the right place at the right time. And I've hung out with him enough and watched esoteric books come his way, like literally there'll be like a box on the street and he'll just reach in and pull out like some cool Manly P. Hall book or something, and I'm like, how do you do that, man? Like I've been around him and he's like, I don't know, I just do it. it's a book magic or something that's really that's cool. So was it hard to let go of those books, or was it actually kind of a relief and nice to have them wind up in a library where other people can have access to them?
Yeah, no, it was always great to find them, because I put them together at the time. You know, you'd find these things for like a quarter to $2, or I think pre-internet the most I ever spent for anything was like maybe $15. And even after the internet came, the good thing about when the internet first came through in 98 with ABE books and did that, where you'd actually use it for something specific, I had at one time a want list of not just Flying Saucer books, but of all books from like the field of the unusual, that numbered about 300 titles. And between 98 and 2000, I was able to cut that back by about 75%. That was during the first couple of years of eBay and the internet book selling services, and when everything was still cheap, before they figured out that everything had to be at least $30, even the books that used to sell for only a dollar somewhere. But I was able to fill up a lot of the gaps in my library during that time. And then I sort of, the UFOs sort of tailed off collecting by the early 2000s, just because they had become so, the ones that were still around were so basically worthless. There was essentially just the same retellings of Little Gray Men stories or things that were just like ridiculous, but I had read them in their original manifestations, you know, cattle mutilations in 66 and 76 and 86 and 96. And so it becomes the same sort of case. You realize you're just reading the same thing over and over again, because at that point people were just working off the images, to some degree, they're already working up the images they already had in their heads.
Yeah. No, I can imagine that it would be nice to, you know, to put an end to that after a while. But were you surprised that the UFO stuff wound up at a place like Georgetown? Is it increasingly the case that university archivists are acquiring things that are this weird? How did that come about?
Oh, that came about. I was working at an archivist at Boudreaux Gallery, and Johann Kugelberg, the fellow who owns it, is, let's see, he had known of my collection for many years and wanted to put together an exhibit. And the book started as like just, you know, a small flyer for the exhibit, and it sort of grew as time went along. And then when he had the book down, he said, well, let's see if we can't sell this. And so Georgetown was pretty much, I think Georgetown was pretty much the first one offered, and they bought it. And that's very good, and I'm glad to have it in a place where it will be seen and used. The two most fascinating things I have seen from the film resulting was, one, watching people I don't know look over books I used to show people in my apartment and say, you can't believe how ridiculous this is. And now people look at it like, oh, look at that. I can't believe how ridiculous that is. And the other thing is just like seeing the covers in the aggregate. In other words, I've always seen them on the shelf, so I knew how many I had. But not until they got into the gallery did I see them ever laid out and facing me. And I realized, oh, my God, this is really artistically something like I've not seen before. And so those were the two things I saw recently from the archiving I discovered. I'm really glad that they will be much more available for public study and whichever, because most libraries did not keep this stuff, as we know. And so now that's why they're doing what they can to, like, preserve it. And that's a very good thing.
Yeah, I want to say, just to emphasize, I mean, one of the wonderful things about your book, of course, is you get to have that experience of all of these covers.
And it's great, remarkable, beautiful, and ridiculous,
and strange and esoteric, and it's just it's really, really remarkable. And also a lot of diagrams. That was one thing. We only have like 2 minutes left here, but I'd love to have you like comment on what you and how you feel about all of the art, the images that go along with this literature, which is so strong in your book.
The diagrams are wonderful. I think I compared them to like the anatomical charts in Japan they do of like the great monsters and such, of Godzilla and such, where you say, oh, so that's where the spinal cords are. And just like, and the flying saucer diagrams from the various books, and they were done specifically as blueprints for the, visually for the book. It's just wonderful because you look at them and just see someone's gone through a lot of work to imagine exactly what might be inside, and well, it could be true, which is always like the basic slogan that I've always gone with by these books. Well, it could be true,
but instead you titled it "They're Real."
The book is great because
your
it's
wit
like
comes well through that.
Yeah, the book is great because it's like having my library in a single volume, which does make things much more easy.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely takes up a lot less room. And if you've been living in this same place in New York for decades, that must be a great relief.
Yeah, yes, that's the case. Oh, yes, I see more wall space every year.
Great. Well, I think we'll have to wind it up there. Any novels on the horizon from you?
Well, let's see. I'm working on one right now, and with luck, should have something by next year. And, you know, everything's still available in print, and Random Acts was reissued a couple of years ago by Golance in the UK, and it gets more attention now than it used to 20 years after it came out, so that's another satisfying situation. And basically just, you know, things are doing okay, and it's great to see how this is taking off. But then with the visuals, I suspected it would.
Okay, well, we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you so much, Jack.
Sure thing, Eric. Thank you.
All right, and all you listeners out there, keep your minds open.